Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Shout out of sympathy and empathy to all the Verizon customers along the East Coast and across the southern United States who have no Wi-Fi today. There you go. I'm among you. Okay, so this past summer, I spent a week in Northeast Georgia. I'm sharing this with you for a reason, not just a personal travel log. It's a place that I consider quite heavenly. It's a place that brings me great joy and a place I love to spend time. I ran into town one afternoon to get some mousetraps, which tells you a little bit about how loose our house is there. A local man furrowed his brow at me in the store. He spoke very, very slowly, as if he suspected that he were about to say something I was not going to understand. With his furrowed brow and his very, very slow tone, he said, "You're not from around here, are you?" And I smiled and I said, "Well, I actually lived here for a number of years. My parents now live just down the road. And we've got a little house up on the mountain where we plan to retire. But no, right now, I don't live here. I live just outside of Nashville." And I paused. And you can tell on his face that's not at all what he meant, that I was not from around there. And I smiled and said, "You know what? I'm really not from Nashville either." It was clearly more information and probably more conversation than the gentleman really wanted, but it did get me thinking. Even in a place where I feel most at home on earth, it's obvious to people that I'm not really from around here. I'm not really home. Now, I was born in Muncie, Indiana. I was raised in Tampa, Florida. I have since lived in New Jersey, Texas, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, and Tennessee. I spent a summer during graduate school working in Southern California. My family now lives largely in Arizona. So where am I from? Where do I belong? Where is home? My most honest answer to that question is this. I'm a member of the household of God. I'm a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. I am here as an ambassador of the king and his kingdom in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And I really do sincerely acknowledge that this world is not my home. I'm quite at home in this world at some points in time and in some places and with some people, but largely I feel like a stranger. I feel like a sojourner. I do love it, but I do also live with a longing to be in the Father's house, to be in a place of perfect peace, to be enjoying the fellowship of the Lord's table, to have reunions with believers who have gone before me, including my best friend, Susan. To be in the midst of the realities of the kingdom where war and disease and pain and disappointment are no more. I mean, who wouldn't long for that? And I'm working very diligently to bring those kingdom principles and kingdom realities to bear here on the earth. But I recognize that I do so as a stranger and an alien. Now, yes, I do stand and pledge allegiance with great patriotism to the flag of the United States of America. I love to sing our national anthem and God Bless America and every other patriotic song that you might want to test my knowledge of. I hold a U.S. passport. I love this land. But beyond my national identity, I recognize that I have a family of faith living in nations under heaven who are going to one day be gathered together in the kingdom that's not of this world. And For me, that's the reality that provides the background and the foundation for the kinds of conversations that we had yesterday here on Connecting Faith about Christian persecution around the world, refugees, and immigration. So if you missed yesterday's rendition of Connecting Faith, I want to invite you to go get it from myfaithradio.com or via the Faith Radio app, download the podcast, share the show with someone else, and really consider what it means to be strangers and aliens here in this world. All right, so on to today's headlines. I want to quickly address two subjects. The first one is life, and the second one is what it means to be human in the sort of current identity crisis of our culture. So first, do we live in a culture that affirms life or death? You heard in the news there at the top of the hour that thankfully, the United States government through HHS has killed a contract that the Food and Drug Administration had with an agency that was selling them aborted fetal human tissue for use in laboratory experiments that included the sort of cross species experimentation with human fetal tissue and mice, and really the ideas behind it are challenging, and yet, you know, those who advocate for stem cell research and the desire for us to make medical advances make their case as well. So I lift up to you another story, this one from California, and you may have missed it. And the reason that I'm lifting it up is in order that we can think about whether or not at this stage of the game we live in a pro-life or a pro-death culture. And I'm also lifting this up because the National Suicide Prevention Month, National Suicide Awareness Month is coming to an end. It's the month of September, and it's now drawing to a close. And I want to highlight that issue again. I want to encourage you to go back and listen to the conversations that we had here with people like June Hunt and others about the subject of suicide and the need for Christians to actively engage on the side of life. So the California Senate passed a measure called AB 282, and they did it on the very first day that the legislature returned from recess. And so a lot of people missed it. It I will tell you, it kind of sailed under the radar. It happened very quickly. The governor signed it into law very quickly. And so I want to highlight it so that we don't miss what's going on. This law grants complete legal immunity to anyone who wants to facilitate the death of someone who is identified as, quote, terminally ill. So they're doing this under California's assisted suicide law. And it allows any person, including someone who might financially benefit from the death of the individual who they are encouraging to kill themselves. So this allows any person to aid, advise, and encourage suicide under the state's assisted suicide law. Until now, these actions were actually felonies because the state had a longstanding policy to protect people from self-harm, and particularly to protect people who were vulnerable, who were in pain. So California's assisted suicide law now allows even what would be described as interested individuals, that includes beneficiaries, to sign the request for assisted suicide drugs. So we're no longer requiring the individual who's making the request of the doctor. We're now allowing people who may benefit from the death of the individual to sign the document requesting the suicide drugs. The new law allows individuals to aid, advise, and encourage a person to commit suicide and actually sign off on the method of that suicide. So in my view, we've reached a new challenging low in the culture of death. And we're going to return to that conversation again, but I wanted to highlight the story and get you thinking about right to life laws or right to death laws or whatever it's called euphemistically in your particular community or state. Secondly, I want to lift up a story about identity. And the reason that I'm doing this is because I think that until we understand what it means to be human, we cannot have the conversation about what it means to be male and female. And so if you want to be engaged in the conversation going on in the culture about identity, and you want to be engaged in the conversation about transgenderism, and you want to be engaged in the conversation about marriage, then you have to back up and have a conversation about what it means to be human and if what it means to be human actually matters. So I have talked before about Tiamat Eva Medusa. Tiamat Eva Medusa is an individual who has undergone extreme body modification to become, by the way, Tiamat Eva Medusa is biologically male, born biologically male, is a transgendered woman and had all of the extreme body modifications done to his body to render him into what appears to be female, but then went on to undergo what everybody describes as extreme body modification, to then become a dragon. This individual had his ears and nostrils removed, had his eyes stained green, and then was covered in scales, these tattooed scales, and has implanted horns on his head. The goal here is to actually stop identifying as a human being and identify instead as a dragon. And you may be saying to yourself, the depth of confusion in that individual is so great that why would we even have this conversation? Well, because if we don't know how to have the conversation about why it matters that a human being is a human being made in the image of God on purpose and for a purpose, uniquely and divinely desired by God as that individual, as a human being, then we cannot possibly know how to engage in a meaningful conversation with girls and boys, men and women, who are in conflict with their physical shape. So this dysmorphia, this body dysmorphia that people suffer from, we can only engage in legitimate conversations with them if we actually not only understand but can articulate what it means to be uniquely human and why that matters and why it's so wonderful. Okay, I'm going to leave that conversation right there. I promise you we will return to it because I am really excited to be joined in just a moment by a representative of Mayo Clinic. We talked yesterday about this exciting new PBS documentary, a Ken Burns documentary, about the Mayo Clinic. I stayed up late for me and watched it. It was excellent. Up next, I'm thrilled to have a representative from Mayo Clinic, Dr. John Wald. He is the medical director for public affairs, and we're going to talk about the documentary, Faith, Hope, and Science. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is an exciting day today because we are joined by Dr. John Wald. He is the medical director for public affairs of the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Wald, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you and your audience today.
So virtually everyone in our direct listening area on the Faith Radio Network is served by a Mayo Clinic or a Mayo Clinic affiliate right where they are in their communities. And I grew up in Florida, and I have family in Arizona. So I have only great history in all of those places with Mayo Clinic. And I was thrilled last night to watch the documentary on PBS, Faith, Hope, and Science. I just want to hear from your perspective, sort of what's the feedback been today?
Carmen, the feedback has been just wonderful today. It's all been positive. I've heard from the members of the Mayo Clinic staff who are thrilled to see their work represented on the big screen and by Ken Burns. And I've heard from people from all over the U.S. through social media and other, with a very hopeful message that, you know, this type of healthcare exists in the U.S. and people are really thrilled that Ken Burns was able to capture what we do at our three destination centers and all of our health system centers in the upper Midwest with such class and such accuracy in a way that few others before him have been able to capture.
Well, the documentary was very educational, and my family watched it together. We learned a lot. We learned actually a lot about the history of America as we, you know, as we watched the movie. That's the way we sort of thought about it. I'm wondering, when you think of those three words that they use in the title, faith, hope, and science, what do those three words tell us about the Mayo Clinic?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the interesting part of it is that it really comes from the DNA that was established by the Mayo family and the Sisters of St. Francis and is woven through everything that we do today. And the interesting thing about it, Carmen, is we did not lead Eric and Chris Ewers, the co-directors of this film, along with Ken, to that DNA. We invited them in. Dr. Millsworthy, our president and CEO, gave them unfettered access to every corner of the clinic, and they were the ones that really came to those three words, hope, faith, and science, which you heard Dr. Brad Nahr speak to. And ultimately, it is what separates us from many other healthcare organizations. When you look at hope, every patient needs hope. Whether we're able to cure them, to provide a procedure or a surgery that takes their disease away, or give them a medicine that takes their disease away, or it's simply letting them know that we've done the best that we can with our integrated care model to get them to a place, even if we can't cure their disease, that they know they've had an accurate diagnosis and they've had a support system around them that empowers them to live with whatever disease that they have. And we all need faith, right? We all need faith in our daily lives. And that's just not a Sisters of St. Francis Catholic-based faith. That faith comes from whatever religion you believe in or whatever denomination of the Catholic faith that you follow. You have to have faith that your care provider is doing what's best for you, that you will come through this. And we've all seen patients with a disease who maybe they're waiting for that one event in their life. They have a terminal disease, they have cancer or a cardiac disease, but they want to get to that wedding, they want to get to that milestone, and they have faith that they'll get there. And then after they've reached that milestone, they actually pass, because it was that faith that they could hold on to that event that they wanted to participate in. And ultimately, we are a scientific organization. We're delivering innovative care and developing the research and innovative tools we need to move healthcare further, faster. But none of that works unless it's based on a foundation of hope and faith.
Friends, I'm talking with Dr. John Wald from the Mayo Clinic, and our conversation is about the PBS documentary that aired last night. Let me just go ahead and tell folks, if you missed it, you can actually watch it via streaming video online at pbs.org. So, Dr. Wald, it may be a surprise to some people that medicine has not actually always been patient-centered. It's very, very clear in the film that at some point, Dr. Mayo began focusing on the patient instead of on himself. And even though the clinic bears the name of the family, I think that what comes through the film is that their concern was always for the people. Am I reading that right?
Absolutely correct. And I think that it's the combination of the Mayo family and the values that the Sisters of St. Francis brought to that relationship that keeps us centered on the patient and the values of this organization. I think without that partnership and without those values being woven throughout 150-year history, it would be very easy to get off track, to make this about doing the procedure, doing the surgery for the money or for the notoriety of what we do. And I've had the opportunity to practice up and down the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey, and I actually, unlike you, wasn't familiar with Mayo Clinic when I came out here. And as you heard me say in the film, the thing that really pulled me to this organization is the fact that this is what medicine was supposed to be, right? When we, as a patient or physician, thought about medicine, it was always about what was best for the patient, how we got to the right answer as soon as we could, and delivered the best care for the patient. And we're not a perfect organization, but at the heart of it, from the technologists to the nurses to the allied health to the volunteers and ultimately to the providers, we truly believe that keeping the patient at the center aligns us to every decision that benefits the organization.
So I really also appreciated the emphasis, or maybe simply sort of sharing with those of us who don't operate in healthcare full time. We each one have our own unique experiences interacting with a healthcare system and healthcare providers. But the uniqueness that, and I think Tom Brokaw is really the person who seemed to highlight this, but you could see it in evidence in virtually every scene. And that was this collaborative approach. Talk about the team approach. And then also this unique feature, or I don't really know, maybe it's not completely unique anymore, that everybody on the faculty at Mayo is salaried. Maybe that's still unique in healthcare. Maybe it's not. Talk about some of those unique things.
So it's wonderful when you have the Mount Rushmore of media, Tom Brokaw, saying the things that he said about Mayo Clinic in this temple that grew up out of the cornfield, because that's a voice and that's an opinion that resonates across America and, frankly, internationally. And what Tom spoke to was not just putting words to a team-based model of care, because many of us have been in a hospital that has residents and interns, and this troop people come in to take care of you. But the difference is that it extends beyond that at Mayo Clinic, that this team-based model of care is like this life chain that starts at the front door when you walk in And the volunteer says, where are you going and how may I help you get there? And it carries through up to the desk attendant and the nurses and the allied health staff. And each one of us, up to the providers, are part of that life chain, which is that integrated care model that keeps patients at the center. And we've been talking about it all the time because a lot of organizations have done a great job of marketing, saying, oh, yeah, we're patient-centered and we're a team-based model of care. But Dr. Noseworthy speaks to it often when he says, when you show up at 8 o'clock on a Monday, and by noon you realize that it truly does exist here at Mayo Clinic, and it's not just words, that's what separates us from many other organizations. And we are a salaried model. We don't get paid by the number of tests that we do or the number of procedures that we do. We get reimbursed based on a certain percentage of what the normal, say, salaries are for physicians or providers in clinics similar to Mayo Clinic across the nation. And it seems like a small thing, but what it does is it allows us all to do what's right for the patient. And we're not doing it because it gives more money to the clinic or to us personally. And you would never want to think that your healthcare provider is making decisions based on finances. But when you're not on a salaried model and you get paid more for doing more, it's hard not to be driven by doing more. And we probably defer more spine surgeries than any other clinic in the U.S. and maybe even internationally, because ultimately, if we don't think that procedure benefits that patient, we'll refer them to physical therapy, to other areas of medicine which we think will benefit them, and not put them through a surgery which we don't think will ultimately lead to a better outcome for them.
Well, there's so many things that I'd love to talk with you about. I loved the highlight on sort of the curiosity and tenacity and adventuresome spirit of tireless work ethic of the Mayos. I loved all of that. I loved the imagery of the cornfields. And I thought that the testimony of the Dalai Lama was really powerful. The only time that I cried, or when I started crying, I'll just admit to you, is when John McCain came on the first time. And so I think that in terms of helping people understand what this documentary includes, there are patient testimonies. There's a lot of visual evidence of what's happening at Mayo Clinic now, but there's this incredible historical look about into the lives of the people really who somehow had within themselves this desire to do surgery and do it really on a massive scale and with great excellence. Dr. Wald, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Friends, you can find it, the documentary, at pbs.org. I got to take a quick break. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thrilled to be joined today by Keith Getty. You know him as half of the dynamic duo of Keith and Kristen Getty. You can find them at Getty Music online, gettymusic.com. You can find them on Facebook and Twitter at Getty Music. Keith, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi there. Delighted to be with you. How are you all doing?
Well, we're just doing great, and thank you for squeezing us in. I know you're about ready to jump on the bus for another tour, so we'll just jump right in. You have been writing hymns for 18 years. I would love for this conversation to simply begin with a conversation about hymnody. Like, why hymns, and why encourage us as Christians to be singing?
Well, you know, God's people throughout history have learned their faith in significant part through what they sing. We see it in the Old Testament, most primarily in the Psalms, but indeed all through the story of God's people and their singing. We see it in the New Testament. We see it through the church fathers through history. We see it in the reformers. We see it in the revivalists, indeed the revivals in American history. And so what we sing is deeply connected. It was Martin Luther who actually said that that the preachers and the teachers will teach the word, and the word will be carried out of church through the songs that we sing, which is why what we sing and what those in our care, in our churches, those in our families, our children, what they sing is so crucially important.
Well, and certainly inspiring families to sing and kids to sing. I know that's a passion for you and Kristen. Why don't you tell people a little bit, if they might not be familiar with Getty Kids, the hymnals that you guys have written, can you talk a little bit about that project before we talk about your North Coast sessions?
Oh, sure. Well, we have four kids. We have four kids, but we're not here to talk about them. They're all female, and they all think they know better than me, and that's okay. I think our focus on children singing became very much sharpened when we had the girls. And so it was interesting. A number of things happened. I remember talking with Dr. John MacArthur once and asking him about advice on raising children. And he said, a lot of it begins with the songs you fill your homes with. And he wasn't talking about family devotionals. He wasn't talking about church or theology. He was simply talking about our homes being filled with songs of the Lord that we can enjoy to sing. And how important that is. That's a challenge for everybody who's a parent, even a grandparent, that their homes are being filled with songs of the Lord. And that's an important thing. Looking at American Christian history, of course, the Sunday school movement started by singing schools, by teaching children to learn their faith through singing it. Indeed, the New England Puritans wouldn't allow a man to take communion on a Sunday if he wasn't singing with his children. So I think there's a great, in the same way as there's a renaissance in hymn writing needed, there's also a renaissance in singing in our homes. My wife always says, you know, singing in church on a Sunday is like a feast that's prepared in the oven during the week, where the oven is the home. And so I think that's really important for all of us. Certainly I, as a worship leader or a hymn writer, have no business standing in the church on a Sunday if I haven't been singing with my kids during the week.
I love that. I think, Keith, that not everybody thinks about what you do as, you know, a real labor. But these songs don't just materialize. These hymns don't just materialize out of nothing. They are actually the evidence of labor over time. Why don't you share with folks, like, on average, you know, how many songs and or hymns do you write? And then how many of them actually get to the place where you feel like this is worthy of being sung outside of my own head or outside of my own study?
Well, to be honest, you know, I think I'm pretty untalented at the end of the day, because at one point we realized that for all the tunes that I record on my iPhone, on my computer, on my manuscript books, because sometimes I like just to write, we reckon about 1 out of 100 becomes a song, which is a really, really low batting average. But, you know, I think that's part of the challenge, isn't it? Is constantly to be working at it. And, you know, all of us, you know, get up each day and, you know, we've got to remind ourselves that, you know, we work to make ourselves holy. We work to honor the Lord, and he provides results. And the problem with songs is if a song isn't fresh, nobody wants to sing it, you know. And so trying to get that little song that just says something in a fresh way and musically it sounds fresh is just so crucial.
Well, and you have certainly blessed us over time with songs that we all love to sing. I know you've got a new project called the North Coast Sessions. Why don't you share with folks sort of the inspiration behind that? And we will, not during this interview, but afterwards, we're going to play for folks something from North Coast Sessions to whet their appetite.
Sure. Well, the North Coast Sessions was the beginning of a new chapter. As you know, the Sing Global Conference happens each year in Nashville. And it's really about helping families and churches sing. And so we invite a lot of theologians with, you know, Rabbi Zacharias, with Joe McCarthy, with John Piper, Tim Keller, and Jay Packer, all did by video. Then we had Alistair Begg and David Platt, and just an extraordinary lineup of people coming to share. And then the wonderful artists from Matt Redman to Andrew Peterson to ourselves to Shane and Shane, just lots and lots of glorious story artists all participating. And it's really on a 5-year program. Next year's, which is last year's was about singing, this year's was about Psalms, and then next year's is in the life of Christ. And it's actually on sale at the minute. But this truth was in the Psalms. And so what we did was Chris and I took 80 days out of our lives just to read the Psalms and set them to music. And then we took the whole band over to Ireland. We had to do a private event anyway. And so we stayed in the little harbor house up in the north coast. And it was just a wonderful time. It was just a really wonderful time. And we're so thankful for it. So it was a, you know, and this was the result of that. We call it the North Coast Sessions. It opens up with a song called I Will Wait For You. And it's a setting of Psalm 130, which we combined with the old Scottish psalm. And our piper actually sat with his pipes playing it, looking over Scotland from the North Coast.
Okay, that guy plays the bagpipes like nobody I have ever heard. When my family listened to that song, I got to tell you, there's jaw-dropping in terms of how beautifully those pipes are played in this song. So sorry to interrupt you, but go right ahead.
No, it's quite okay. That's right, and he does that. And so we're really excited. But it's the launch of a new chapter of writing psalms and creating a soul, a modern soldier for the church. So we're very, very excited about it.
All right, Keith. Well, before we let you go, just one more thing, and thank you again for being so gracious with your time today. When folks look forward to Sing 2019, what would you say to them in terms of energizing them to, you know, to have them want to come and participate?
Well, I think with Sing 2019, it's journeying through the life of Christ. So it's a beautiful time. It's at the Opryland Hotel. The concerts are going to be at the Grand Ole Opry, so you get to go to the Opry House itself. Then the Tuesday night, we're having a special celebration of Christ's resurrection with John Piper, in the Bridgeton Arena, 16,000 people all singing in the round with a choir of 2,000, which is going to be amazing. And Johnny Tadd is going to be part of that. It's our band with a few special guests who will be announced very soon. And so we're really excited about that. Then, as I said, it really goes through all of Christ's life and all of the church's year as well. So we'd say it's the 19th to 21st of August. Bring your band, bring your church music group, or bring your church leadership, or bring your family. It's a great year to go into the Opryland as well because they're opening their new water park. So it's just a fantastic place to go next year and be part of this. So we're pretty excited about it. And to have John MacArthur and John Piper and a number of Oz Guinness and some of the world's great speakers in the faith all coming to share. It's going to be a really special time.
All right. Well, we're really excited with you. Keith Getty, thank you so much. Friends, you can get information about everything we have talked about today at gettymusic.com. Keith Getty, thank you so much for joining us on Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much indeed. Thank you.
All right, friends, we've got to take one more quick break, and then when we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, obviously, the news headlines are filled with all kinds of things that a family-friendly show like ours simply can't talk about. So let me highlight this. It was actually really timely that we had the opportunity to talk with Keith Getty today. And sorry that I didn't let you know that he was going to be on when I concluded my conversation with Dr. Wald from the Mayo Clinic. I got a little carried away and I kind of forgot. So I apologize for that. And so it was great to have both of those guests on today. I love it when we can have conversations with folks about the headline news, and then we can enter into the conversations of the day in meaningful ways. So in terms of my conversation with Keith Getty, it was really kind of cool to get to talk with him today because he's a Christian songwriter. And actually, had he been any kind of songwriter, today would have been a great day to talk with him, because we're actually, you and I benefit every single day because there are artists out there, creators out there who write songs. And then obviously other people record them and we broadcast them and all kinds of cool stuff like that. Well, those people actually make their living when we buy their recordings. They don't make a living when we download their stuff for free or bootleg it or whatever else. And so we want everybody to get paid for their work. But that does not always happen, because technology actually makes it really easy for people to not pay the creative people. And so something's happening on Capitol Hill that I can celebrate. And I can celebrate it because it's bipartisan. And it is, and it's good. It's good for people. It's good for the Gettys. It's good for people like the Gettys. So there's a bipartisan piece of legislation. You're probably not even going to hear about it in the secular press, because who in the world would be talking about the Music Modernization Act? But the Music Modernization Act is on the verge of becoming law in the United States of America. So the United States House of Representatives yesterday voted unanimously. I want to highlight that, and I want to say it again, because it's not very often that the House of Representatives, that Congress votes unanimously on anything. So I want you to think about that. The U.S. Congress actually was all in one accord yesterday. They were all in harmony on this particular issue, and it's called the Music Modernization Act. So this is a piece of legislation that was really, I think, crafted by the working together of people in the music industry and people in the technology industry. And lots of creators across the country who are bringing music copyright law into the digital era. And so this Music Modernization Act will result in what folks are telling me is the most significant improvement of music copyright law in more than a generation. Why does that matter? Because everybody out there who thinks they've got one song in them that could become the next I Can Only Imagine, or could become the next In Christ Alone, or could become the next On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand, or whatever, whatever you think you've got in you, if you ever want people are singing it and billions of people are listening to it, then you actually need really good music copyright laws. And so this actually makes it easier for creators across the music industry to earn a fair living, to actually get paid for that which they have done. So I just thought that I would lift it up because it seemed very timely that Rachel Sutton scheduled Keith Getty to be on the show today. So shout out to Rachel for that. All right. One more thing. In terms of headlines that have been topping the news across virtually every channel, and I'm talking
well, folks, we apologize. We're having some technical issues staying connected to Carmen at the moment. We're trying to reconnect with her here in just a moment. So if you can please be patient, stand by with us as we try to reconnect with Carmen. We will get her back on the line here shortly. Thank you.
All right, friends, we're just going to pick up right there. So for 49 days, a young man named Aldi Adelong survived on the Pacific Ocean. I want you to think about that. And so here's what happened. According to the Washington Post, this Indonesian teenager was working as a lamp keeper. First of all, who even knew that was a job? On a small floating fishing hut. It's known as a rompog. A storm caused the line that was tethering his raft to snap, and it sent this young man adrift in shark-infested waters in the Pacific Ocean. If you're wondering why he didn't jump off and swim to shore while there was still time, it's because, let's highlight again, shark-infested waters in the Pacific Ocean. So he was literally adrift for 49 days. How long have you been adrift? And here we're not talking about being unmoored from a tether that is connecting you to reality or connecting you safety and security. We're talking here about that which tethers us in life. And are you adrift? I think it's a good spiritual question to ask. I think it's a really easy question to ask when this kind of headline news streams across every digital platform in front of us. And so I think the conversation about how it is that Jesus Christ is our anchor, and how it is that we are connected to him, and how it is that through him we are connected to God and connected to one another. I mean, I think all of those are really good talking points if you want to engage with people in the conversation of this particular news story. It goes on. He would spend the next 7 weeks fighting for his life, surviving only on fish he caught and seawater that he filtered through his clothes. Okay, I have to admit to you, I didn't even know that was possible. I didn't even know it was possible to use your clothing to sufficiently filter the salt out of seawater in order that you could drink it. I also don't know that I'm a proficient enough fisherman or fisherwoman to actually, catch enough stuff that I could survive on. And I think we're talking here about like sushi grade in terms of how you're eating it. So I just give that some thought. How long would you survive? We talk about Jesus going 40 days in the wilderness voluntarily without food or drink. But the rest of us, you know, we can fast, but we couldn't fast that long, and certainly not from water. And so what kind of conversations might you have with folks about not just what's their survival plan, but what's their thriving plan? And what would you do? What would you do if it were literally, left up to you to survive? I think it's a good opportunity to talk with folks about the resources that God makes available to us and how, how he cares for us. All right. The New York Post, in reporting on this same story, said this young man read from his Bible every single day. He knew from whence his help was going to come. First of all, the fact that he had a Bible with him is extraordinary to me. Some missionary at some point in time went to Indonesia and led to faith someone who then led to faith the Adelong family, who imparted into their child the faith of our Savior, Jesus Christ. And the Bible is so important to him that he took it with him to his job as a lamp keeper on a Rongpog. He had his Bible with him, and he read from it every day. Are you reading from your Bible every day? It's pretty convicting when we think about this young teenager working at night in order to support himself and his family, and having his Bible with him under this particular circumstance. The article that I'm reading from goes on, Adelong also received strength by heeding advice given to him by his parents. When desperate, pray. Now, I would actually, go with Paul here and say, pray in all circumstances. Pray without ceasing. Pray under every pray in and, in and out of season. There's never a bad time to pray. But I get it that you would be encouraging your child to be certain that when things are desperate, when we're desperate, we certainly need to pray. What kind of advice are we given to our kids? I loved Keith Getty's emphasis on singing with our kids and the songs that we're singing in our homes. I love the image of this young man reading his Bible every day, even though he's adrift at sea for 7 weeks. And then I love that his parents have advised him in this way: when desperate, pray. What advice would come to mind if your kids were in a time of trouble? Would they remember that their parents had told them to pray? And would they know how to do it? Would they have been in prayer in the context of your family often enough that they would know how to pray? I think those are good questions. It also got me thinking. Nowhere in this story does it talk about what the family was doing during the 7 weeks that this young man was missing. I imagine that the Adelong family, along with their church and their friends, were pounding on the doors of heaven, asking the Lord to protect and provide for that young man adrift at sea, knowing not whether or not he was dead or alive, but praying that in whatever circumstance he was in, he would not feel alone, that he would know that God was with him, that he would be inspired to pray, that he would be inspired to read the Word of God. And all of those things, that's exactly what happened. This young man, in the course of those 49 days, watched 10 different vessels pass by without seeing him. Finally, the article says, Adelong's prayers were answered. On August 31, a bulk carrier, Arpeggio, sailed past him. He waved his clothes again for help, but they didn't see him. This is as it's reported in the Jakarta Post. Here's a quote. At first, the ship's crew did not see him, so Aldi tuned his radio to a frequency that a friend of his had once told him to use. And guess what, friends? The lost was found. First of all, that's a little shout-out to the power of radio. And as a radio broadcaster, I just want to celebrate that for a moment. I also want to celebrate the power of a friend's advice. What kind of advice are we giving to our friends? And is it the kind of advice that would actually lead them to, in this case, salvation in a time of desperation and need? What are the kinds of things that you and I are telling our friends that would come to mind and would be helpful in a time of deep distress? I think this is a story about never giving up hope. I think that this is a story about the presence of God. When you can't see your way out of a really desperate circumstance, I think it's evidence and a reminder that help has to come from the outside when we're lost. I think it's a reminder that a lot of times our lives are adrift. We've lost our way. We've lost our bearing. We've lost our ability to even know which direction to go. And we certainly couldn't swim or paddle that far because, after all, the waters are shark infested. This is a great story for you to use today in your conversations with others about prayer, about scripture, about the power of a faith-filled family and imparting the faith one generation to another. It's a great story about salvation. It's a great story about never giving up hope. So if you know a person who is adrift, pray with me for them, or I'll pray with you for them, even as we recognize that this young man's family and his friends and his church was ardently praying for him. They did not know the circumstances, whether or not he was even alive or dead. And you may know someone in your life who's close to your heart, and you don't know if they're alive or dead. But we can go before the Lord. Because the Lord knows. The Lord knows where they are. The Lord knows their circumstance. The Lord can bring to mind the advice that you gave them when they were young, that they could turn to him when they were desperate. The Lord can put a Bible in their hands. If you've never heard Christopher Yuan's story in relationship to finding a Bible in the trash can in prison, let me just tell you, God has ways of getting his word into people's hands just at the right time. So I'm going to pray today for all of those who have family members who are off the grid, who are adrift, who are missing. We don't know where they are, and we don't know the circumstances of their lives. But let us pray that the God who knows all and sees all and has the ability to do things that we rarely dare to ask or imagine would intervene right now in their lives, would bring them to a point of intersection with somebody who knows the gospel, who can speak into their life in a way that is truly salvific. All right, friends, that is all the time we have here today on Connecting Faith. Thank you for joining me. You can always go to myfaithradio.com and find the Connecting Faith page and share today's show with someone new. My ministry website is reconnectwithcarmen.com, and you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.